accession number 27083, reel 55.
So Henry, you managed to persuade the Nimrod to fly to Bryce Norton, where you were picked up by your car.
Yes, and I got back to Avenue House at Northwood, where I had two choices. I could either have breakfast, or I could have a bath. But I couldn't have both. There wasn't time before the NATO Council arrived. So I had a bath. And that's one of the rare occasions in my life. I'd had breakfast at quite unusual times, like 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock even in the evening, during exercises, but I had to miss it altogether then. Well, the NATO Council came. They behaved very well. They were very courteous. They were led by the Secretary General, Joe Luntz, who, I can't remember what his problem was. I think he may have had a heart condition. But he, whenever he sat down for a meal, he would range alongside his glass, he would range a series of very brightly colored pills. Some were red, some were blue, some were white, some were yellow. And there would be anything up to half a dozen of these things. But he never looked, he never blanched at all. He was a marvelous man.
Whilst we're on the subject of NATO, can I just ask you this question? It goes right back, if I may, to the NATO, the Nuclear Planning Group, of which you have managed to make yourself a member.
Yes.
Did you... I want to ask you two questions. I'll just deal with the first. Did you feel that you were really on your mettle, that you were put to it to deal with Al Haig and perhaps Admiral Kidd, but Al Haig in particular, who was so much of a politician, and given the fact that everybody else present was a politician?
Yes, absolutely. Because the subjects discussed almost invariably had a technical, professional, military, if you like, flavor, and I reckon I was entirely up to that. No, I never felt embarrassed.
Fine. And you've half answered the second question, which was, could you give me an example of the decisions that were taken within it? Because this is the central... You're giving me the impression that this is the central decision-making body. You said that the margins, as often in the case for these things, that the margins more is done than in the centre, but within the NPG, this was the principal decision-making body. Can you give me an idea of the questions you were addressing?
I'm not sure that I can now, but as you just pointed out, it was in the margins, and that's where the real business got done, because at the formal meetings, there was a preconceived, predetermined agenda. It was usually a fairly innocuous agenda, and it was, particularly if it had any controversial aspects, bearing in mind that it was only America, Britain, France, but with her peculiar NATO position, different, that had a nuclear capability. And so the others really were not in the position to discuss that sort of thing, if it was at all technical. Can we... Well, as I think I said earlier, we got back to Northwood. I had a bath rather than breakfast. The NATO Council arrived, and they were a very nice lot. And of course, when it came to that, towards the end of lunch, I had to get to my feet and make a speech of welcome and so forth. And they were a pretty serious lot. I thought I'd better treat them, and I didn't very often have an opportunity to do so. And so I got up and I led them up the path a bit and said that I knew what terribly experienced all members of the NATO Council were in their affairs and so forth. But I wasn't sure whether they realized that what they were experiencing right then was something that, to my knowledge, none of them had ever experienced before. And I dwelt a long pause, and they were all looking up and paying attention, wondering what the hell I was going to say next and that sort of thing. And I went on and I said, so far as I'm aware, none of you has ever before sat down for lunch at the same table as a common hijacker. And there was another ghastly pause, and then I told them the story, and they all burst out laughing. It went down very well. I turn now to one of the NPG meetings, which took place in Denmark under very tight security. Very tight security indeed.
We're now in 1979?
We're now in 78 or 79.
Okay.
Yes, I think we are. We're in 79. Spring of 79, I think. You can check this, but total time, anyway. And the care was intense, and there were soldiers everywhere and so on. And in due course, the meeting was... And we all forget, which was the sort of the pride of the country. And those lunches used, and they were beautifully done, sat around a horseshoe table, exactly like a horseshoe. And hence you can check easily on the date. And foreign minister, I think he was, Aldo Moro, had been kidnapped. And this had occurred, it was something like 3 weeks before, and not a word was heard from the kidnappers, still less the whereabouts of Aldo Moro. And 3 weeks had passed since he'd been lifted, and it was increasingly thought that, because no specific demands had been made, I don't think, and it was increasingly thought that the poor chap had been bumped off. And we got about halfway through lunch, the Ageville and all that stuff, when there was suddenly a bit of a hush. And the next thing one knew was that the Italian delegation, numbering three or four, because there were always some hangers-on, rose to its feet, left the table, and with tears streaming down their cheeks, left the room. And the sort of subdued atmosphere went on, and it was almost whispered around the horseshoe table. They found Aldo Moro's body. So Al Haig, who was all for making anything out of nothing, raised his feet and made a short speech, in the course of which he offered that his personal aircraft was at the disposal of the Italian delegation to take them straight back home. And the hush continued. And then Ike Kidd raised to his feet and in his great booming voice did the same thing. That his personal aircraft was at the disposal of the Italian delegation to take them straight back to Italy. And the Allied Commander-in-Chief Channel did not rise to his feet or make any such statement at all, because he didn't have a personal cross. We dragged our way through lunch, and then we reassembled without the Italians. And to start with, Joe Luntz, the Secretary General, who was always in the chair on these occasions, he crashed the table with his tomahawk gavel, and he said that we would stand in for a minute's silence in memory of Aldo Moro, which we did, and we sat down. And our permanent representative to NATO at the time was a splendid man who's only recently died, called John Killick, who had been our ambassador to the Soviet Union. Very good man, very lively intellect, totally without pomp, sharp as a needle, and great fun to be with. And I was sitting just behind him, and he turned round and said, typical John Killick crack, said with a wry grin, "I do hope they've found the right body." And then he turned back, and we giggled, and the meeting went on. Well, I mention this because they had not found the right body. I don't know who it was they had found, but it was not Aldo Moro, and his body wasn't found for some days, until some days later. Another place I visited, was Aswan, the big dam. The Egyptians were desperate for the dam to be completed, and it was the Russians who built it.
It was still not completed in 78.
It was still not completed in 78, 79. Well, I say it wasn't completed. The dam was completed, but the effects, the result, a lot had to be salvaged, because the Egyptian government had said, in answer really to the Russians' query, if you want this thing to run to program, then it will be at the expense of having flooded a number of historic remains. Or we can, of course, hold back, but we'd rather not, and it'll add to the expense, and they haven't got the money, etc., etc. So they decided to go ahead with it.
Well, which Abu Simbel was the most prominent.
Yes, remain. Indeed.
Yeah.
So they completed the dam, and they flooded it up, and a lot of artifacts were flooded. And we had offered on the diplomatic net to send a team from the Fleet Clearance Divers out to Aswan in conjunction with, I think they were Egyptian Navy divers, in fact I'm sure that they were, to work with them just to swell the expert talent for diving. And it was not terribly deep diving, it was 30 feet or so, with a view to removing, the name escapes me, it wasn't Abu Simbel, it was, I think it was the Temple of Caesar Augustus, which was composed of huge blocks of stone, which must have weighed best part of a ton each, and so forth. And I saw the leader of this detachment from the Fleet Clearance Diving Team at Northwood before he left, and wished him luck. And I promised that if I could, but I had nothing actually in mind at the time, I would visit him while he and his men were on the job, which would be a good thing to do and boost their morale and so forth. But no opportunity sprung to mind at the time. So it seemed to me to be rather an empty gesture. In the event, I was able to fit this in. And I had a mammoth tour to visit India and to visit Pakistan. But because you couldn't visit one after or before the other, you had to fit something in between. I also visited Bangladesh, and that made life a bit easier for the foreign offices, and so forth. So en route, I said I would drop in on the team at Aswan, and I did. And I'm very glad I did. It was a remarkable, a classic bit of international, mutual, professional cooperation. They lived in a nearby tourist hotel, quite a good one. They all wore tracksuits. Most of the Egyptians spoke a bit of English, and our people were beginning to learn a bit of Egyptian and so forth. They got on terribly well. There was a leader of each national team, but rank didn't come into it, hence the tracksuits and so forth. The diving vessel was an ex-Russian river steamer, vintage about 1901, coal-driven, and so forth. And what was remarkable was that they were in the throes of salvaging these enormous blocks of stone and laying them out in a field nearby, having got them ashore in barges and things, each one being marked as to where the sort of area they'd found it in, so that with any luck the archaeologists would piece them back together and remake the whole thing. I don't know the extent to which they've achieved that, but anyway, it was beautifully done, beautifully organized. And it really was a tonic to see how these two utterly different personalities in terms of the teams got on together, they lived together, they ate together, no problem about food and so forth. And it was remarkable. It can be done. Doesn't all that often happen. I'm not going to describe the visits to India and Bangladesh and Pakistan. They were very fine, very good indeed. They looked after me beautifully. But of course, these things are quite punishing to the system at the time. They last 4 or 5 days. You really have no respite in the course of those days. You are a bit short of sleep at the end. You're then faced with a flight on to the next one, and you probably don't sleep terribly well during that, if indeed there's time for it, and so on. But they were successes. They were all very hospitable, very courteous. And of course, it was a great experience to be able to do this. I visited, I think, both before, but not Bangladesh, from ships. And this was seeing it from a rather different aspect. And very impressive it was. I turn now to the fact that I hadn't actually flown a naval F-4 Phantom. I had an RAF one, which I described earlier on when I was FOF 1. And I became aware that our own fleet Aeron was reluctant to allow me to do so. And I finally got on to the flag officer, Naval Air Command, or whatever he called himself at the time. They keep on changing the names down there. I think I put my flag lieutenant onto it. told him to find out what it was that was bugging them. Why was this antipathy? They ought to be only too delighted that their commander-in-chief was prepared to risk his life in flying one of their dreadful machines, and so on. And they did. And the answer was that I had not been through their workup, their training bit of parachute dragging drill, which took place in the huge swimming bath at Yeovilton. And I said, right, fix me a date and I will go down and do the para-dragging thing. And then I shall be eligible. And then, because I knew I was going out to Ark Royal in due course, and that for that. And down I went. And I knew the captain well. I knew the commander not so well. And the safety equipment officer, who was really in charge, had been my safety equipment officer when I was captain of Albion. So that was an old friend. And they told me what they were going to do, which was that I was to be dressed in flying overalls, including a Mae West, and including a sort of parachute harness, but not the parachute itself. And they would tie a heaving line around my waist, invite me to go to the top board in the high diving end of the swimming pool, and a tough physical training instructor on the other end of the heaving line. When I raised my hand to indicate that I was ready, would pull me over backwards, because you had to face away from the pool, and I would hit the water splat, and they said, it's dead easy, sir. All you do is to spread out your legs and spread out your arms, and you will plane to the surface. And when you do, you release your parachute harness. And the parachute harness has, it's a sort of double acting thing, and you have to push up on a spring-loaded flap, get your fingers in, and then you pull down on another spring-loaded flap, and then you're clear. Except that somebody had banged out of a Phantom, I think, and hadn't got this quite right. And as he ejected, he lost his parachute, so that was the end of him. And this was discovered afterwards. As a result of which, they had inserted a split pin, which you had to extract from each side, each bosom, so to speak, before you did the up and down and release.
This is quite a performance now, isn't it?
It's a bit of a performance. But if you're planing to the surface, as I was advised, okay. I have to admit, I was terrified of the whole performance, because I'm the world's worst swimmer. I knew they'd drown me one way or another, and I wasn't looking forward to it. And I'd never been on the top board of the high.
So you were 20 feet up?
Something like, I don't think much more, no.
20 feet.
Something like that. Right? Typical sort of swimming pool thing, not special for this drill, I don't think. And I was lucky not to exhibit the shakes before getting up there, at least I don't think I did. And I faced away from the bath, and I took a very deep breath, and I raised my hand, and I was pulled over backwards, and I hit the water splat.
And then you're pulled through the water.
Yes.
By a device.
And I spread my legs, and I spread my arms, and the PTI at the other end of the pool, the other end of the heaving line secured around my waist, was pulling and pulling and pulling. And I indeed, as advised, I got up on the step, and I got about halfway down the bath, when that was it. You know, I'd passed. And I was frightfully pleased with myself, and I dog paddled to the side and got out. thinking, you know, they always exaggerate these things, and there's nothing to it. Right, sir, said the captain of Yeovilton. Now, we do the same again, but you've lost an arm in the course of ejecting. Which arm have you lost, sir? And I thought, God, you S-H-I-T. And being very right-handed, I said I'd lost my left arm. And the PTI, who was standing quite close, said, it's all right, sir, I'll only give you a gentle pull. And I didn't see through this. And up I went, brimful of confidence, no longer shaking like a leaf, and I climbed to the top cord. Didn't even bother to take a particularly deep breath. Raised my hand, was pulled over backwards, spread my legs, spread my arms, and nothing happened. I did not plane to the surface. The reason I didn't plane to the surface, of course, was he gave me a gentle pull.
Yes.
And I hadn't seen through this like an ass. And I fumbled. I fumbled, really desperate to inflate my Mae West. And I couldn't find the thing. And by this time, I was underwater, of course. And I was running very short of a breath. And I stopped fumbling about with split pins, and even the Mae West, come to that, and concentrated on trying to get a hand above the surface to indicate that I was an unhappy senior, and very unhappy too. And the only reason, the point of this extremely silly story, is that you will be aware of the saying that as you are drowning or falling or whatever to your death, which is a matter of seconds away, you relive a substantial part of your past life. And this is true. I relived it. They put a diver in that got underneath me and held me up and pulled me to the side of the bath, and I lay like a fish, gasping and getting rid of quite a lot of water. I didn't quite black out, but I wasn't very far off it. And meantime, they were running up and down the side of the bath, splitting their sides with laughter at their commander-in-chief, who was behaving in such an extraordinary fashion. Well, that was that. I got my clearance chit for flying an F-4.
Oh, they passed you despite...
Yeah, they passed me despite this. But it was a nasty experience, and I haven't forgotten it. That was, I suppose, number 7 of my nine lies. And I could go on, because as you can imagine, it was a very busy life. I did my 2 years there. It was busy NATO-wise, it was busy nationally, it was busy in every way. It was a super job. I had a very good team to support me. I've already mentioned the chiefs of staff, both national and NATO. Very good. They're both dead, sadly, now. But we kept in touch afterwards and for long years. I inherited a flag lieutenant from my predecessor, John Treacher. A very nice lad called Jamie Miller, who has just recently retired as a commodore, where he's done a very good job indeed. He was sunk twice in the Falklands War and survived it all. And he in turn was relieved by a man called Stephen Meyer, who I had some difficulty in selecting because all sorts of people were trying to wish somebody of their choice, not mine, onto me as my new flag lieutenant. The Royal Marines did, and they produced, I'm sure, a very charming chap, but as thick as two planks. And I was quite ruthless about selecting my flag lieutenant, as indeed I had been when I was FOF 1. And I reckoned that I was entitled to a kindred spirit, a congenial soul, who I could discuss things that maybe I shouldn't have discussed with somebody of that level. But I could do so, and he would be discreet, and he would not pass it on. And I could use him as a mental sharpening stone during the long flights, and there were a number of those, and so on. So I was very lucky in my choice of flag lieutenant.
So Henry, we'll pause and change tapes there if we may.
Right.